Health Science and Energy Show, July 4th, 2000 and what year?
Eight.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have some interesting guests coming up here soon. One person I'm communicating with now, his name is Leonard Susskind. And he's a very good friend of Stephen Hawking and Gerard de Hooft. And worked with John Wheeler and some of the most famous physicists, including my role model, Richard Feynman, who's no longer with us on this planet. And I'm reading his book called The Black Hole War, and we'll bring him on the show here probably, I would say, in 3 or 4 weeks, hopefully. He's over in Cambridge, England right now doing some, he's like the best, he's Felix Bloch professor at Stanford, so I mean he's a pretty famous guy. And the book The Black Hole War is my battle with Stephen Hawking to make the world safe for quantum mechanics, and it's well written. It's an interesting book because Stephen, of course, Einstein didn't even want to go into quantum mechanics. He didn't believe in it. He called it spooky action in the distance. And then Stephen Hawking said that information is lost in a black hole, which physicists didn't want to really talk about that. And if you look at the Rays of Truth book that I wrote, there's a real interesting section in there about black holes and the energy and how the energy moves from a black hole back into a cell during mitosis through many, many dimensional changes. And, of course, we'll get into different brains or dimensions of math and all this kind of stuff when we bring Leonard on. He's you can see a lot of his work on YouTube. Just type in Leonard, L-E-N-A-R-D, Susskind, S-U-S-S-K-I-N-D. And it's fascinating. Those of you that want to learn more about the projector technology and what it's all about, will get a heck of a dose of it from a quantum level on the physics. But anyway, today, it's kind of a different day. I want to talk about one of my relatives. I'm a direct descendant of Ethan Allen. Even as most of you know, I was a descendant of Alexander Graham Bell. But Ethan Allen Alexander Graham Bell was on the uncle side, cousin side, or whatever. Even though I've got pictures of him in the family tree, Ethan Allen was a direct descendant. He was like a great grandfather. I'm going to discuss a little article here, and I'll tell you a little story at the end. On a warm spring morning of May 10th, 1775, State Old Fort Ticonderoga on the western shore of Lake Champlain was a bedlam of rejoicing. Cannon boomed, men laughed, cursed, muskets cracked, body songs seasoned the air, and rum barrels popped as they lost their stoppers. Now remember, Ethan Allen is who we're celebrating today on July 4th. He's the one who had Colonel Parker fire a shot on the Lexington-Concord Bridge. The sound of a scratching pen came from the open window of the commandant's office, where a huge man in buckskins named Ethan Allen was seated at the desk, composing a letter. Occasionally, he paused to grin down at the raucous celebration on the parade ground below and to take a reflective swig from a mug of rum. Maybe that's where I got my drinking enjoyment from, Ethan Allen, because nobody else in my family that I could think of ever drank anything. "I have to inform you with pleasure, unfelt before," he wrote, "that on the break of day took the fortress Ticonderoga by storm. The soldiery was composed of about 100 green mountain boys and near 50 veteran soldiers from the Providence of Massachusetts Bay. The soldiers' bravery behaved with such restless, resistless fury that they so terrified the king's troops that durst not a fire on their assailants, nor our soldiery was agreeably disappointed. The soldiery behaved with uncommon rancor when they leaped into the fort." And then he signed it with a flourish: "Ethan Allen, Commandant of Ticonderoga." He did not mention a certain Colonel Benedict Arnold, who sat sully in another room in the fort, also writing. Arnold was noting in his diary that Ethan Allen is a proper man to lead his own wild people, but wholly unfit for military command. That's Ethan Allen. He added that the... Now I've got to find the next page here. That was on the other side. Just a second here. Let's see here. He added that the Green Mountain Boys had called him vile names and fired their muskets in a manner, sending the balls whistling close by me. Benedict Arnold, attended by his valet and wearing the most gilded braided plumed uniform ever seen in the Green Mountains, had galloped up that morning on a white horse while the boys were preparing to march on the fort. Haughtily, he told Allen, Ethan, that a committee in Massachusetts had authorized him, Colonel Arnold, to lead the attack. Hang the fancy peacock, one of the boys immediately suggested. But Ethan, who was an outlaw with a price on his head, decided Colonel Arnold's papers might lend some legality to the engagement. Diplomatically, he told Arnold to march beside him at the head of the column, explaining that his men would only serve under their own officers. But several times as they marched, Arnold demanded leadership. By God, sir, Ethan thundered, finally laying hand on the hilt of his sword, I'll have you know that I'm in command here. Since Ethan Allen's reputation as a salvage outlaw was already legendary, and since he stood 6.5 feet tall, he was a great big guy, and he could bellow like a bull, Colonel Arnold decided not to press the point. Besides, it is questionable that a fancy man like Arnold could have led this strange army. Most of the boys wore buckskins, but a few had donned their Sunday best, and they carried a miscellany of muskets, blunderbusses, fowling pieces, pistols, clubs, and hunting knives. Interesting, huh? When a British sentry woke from a sound sleep to see this wild horde charging out of the dawn, led by a roaring giant waving an immense sword, he fired one hasty shot and immediately took to his heels. The boys right behind him, yelling, yelling like Indians. One redcoat, half-dressed, darted out of the barracks with a fixed bayonet and received the flat of Ethan's sword across his skull. Subdued, he led the way to the officers' quarters. There, a man wearing the coat of a British lieutenant, but carrying his breeches in one hand, appeared in the doorway and asked, reasonably enough, by what authority this rabble had entered the premises of the Crown. In the great name of Jehovah and the Continental Congress, Ethan told him, I have possession of the fort and all the effects of George III. Soon Ethan was writing to Governor Trumbull at Connecticut, I make you a present, Major, a captain, and two lieutenants in the regular establishment of George III. I hope they may serve as a ransom for some of our friends at Boston. Another letter addressed to Hartford Committee of War displayed justice to the fallen enemy. Sir, he wrote, whereas the fortress of Ticonderoga had fallen into the hands of the colonies together with the ordinary stores, and whereas British Captain William D. LaPlace has in the fort 90 gallons of rum and his own property, which is greatly wanted for the refreshment of the fatigued soldiery. This is therefore to desire the treasurer of the colony of Connecticut to pay him the S.D. William DePlace 18 pounds, 11 shillings and 9 pence, lawful money, as the rum is appropriated for the use of the garrison. Your compliance will oblige the garrison and your humble servant, Ethan Allen, commandant of Ticonder. Ticonderoga is where history finds Ethan Allen, where it leaves him. Yet, before taking the fort, he was already famous in the colonies, or infamous. George Washington said, there is an original something in him that commands attention. At the same time, a Vermont settler begged the governor of New York to send troops because otherwise our persons and property must be at the disposal of Ethan Allen, which is more dreaded than the death with all the terrors. Now, he was a big, pushy kind of guy. Many columnists believe that he was Satan himself, or at least a close cousin. They pointed to his gargantuan size and his ability to drink more rum and use more profanity per sentence than any mere human. They even memorized his more lurid statements, such as, damn your governor, your laws, your king, council, and assembly. We're going to make a hell of a Monroe's house and burn in it, and every loathsome reptile it takes apart. To demonstrate his immense strength, he hoisted bushel bags of salt in his teeth and tossed them over his shoulder without touching them. Alone once, he met a sheriff and six deputies and left them battered and bleeding on the ground. He was at war years before the Revolution, for he organized the Green Mountain Boys to fight the hated New Yorkers, whom he called mercenary monopolizing men, and the infamous fraternity of diabolical plotters, who leave women sobbing, children crying, and men pierced to the heart with sorrow and indignation as the approaching tyranny of New York. Legend has it, on the day he was born, it was January 21, so he's a Capricorn. Oh, see, January was a Pisces. 1738, earthquakes shook Litchfield, Connecticut, and comets crossed the sky. So let's do the numerology on that. 8 and 1 is 9, that cancels. 7 and 3 is 10, that's a 1. 21 plus 1, that's a 4. 5, it was a 5. Ethan himself remarked that he knew of but two women who were successfully delivered of seven devils with horns and tails, Mary Magdalene and Mary Allen, his mother. Originally destined for Yale, he became the teenage head of a large frontier family when his father died. At 19, he gave the farm to his brothers and went off to fight the French in the Indian Wars and returned filled with restless energy. He tried business, wheeling and dealing in real estate, then building England's first large blast furnace at Salisbury, Connecticut. He married a miller's daughter, but he boarded her with his brothers and their families while he raged up and down the colony, buying and selling real estate at a furious pace and letting his hot temper getting him into trouble. On one occasion, he had himself inoculated against smallpox, which was then illegal. When two town selectmen, the Reverend Jonathan Lee and Mr. Stoddard, threatened to prosecute him, okay, now I've got to find, that's an old article, it's been in the family a long time, and I've got to figure out where the next page went. He lost his temper. He wound up in court charged with blasphemy for uttering the following: "By Jehovah, I wish I may be bound down in hell with old Beelzebub 1,000 years in the lowest pit in hell, and every little insipid devil would come along and ask by the reason of Alan's lying there. Why is Alan lying there? It should be said because he made a promise here in cold blood that he would have the satisfaction of Lee and Stoddard and did not fulfill it." Also noted in the court records of the time of his entry, they said Ethan Allen did it in a tumultuous and offensive manner when threatening words and an angry look stripped himself even to his naked body, and with force and arms without law or right did assault and actually strike the person of George Caldwell in the presence and to disturbance of many of His Majesty's good subjects. The next day, records say, Ethan Allen ran into poor George. The cause of the feud is unknown, and soon after, in a violent, angry temper, stripped him of his clothes, his naked body, with a club struck Caldwell on the head. And a few hours later, Ethan stripped off his clothes to his naked body, and in a threatening manner, with his fist lifted up, repeated malicious words three times. "You," meaning George Caldwell, "lie, you dog," and also did, with a lousy voice, say that he would spill the blood of any that opposed him. In July 1767, the selectmen of Northampton, where he had been managing a lead mine, banished him for blasphemy and righteous riotousness. He was glad enough to go, for the colonies were getting too settled, too stifling. Leaving his family with his brother, he sat out along the Hampshire Grants, now called Vermont, where he spent the winter on snowshoes, exploring the Green Mountains and living on venison. The Grants were disputed lands. The handful of settlers held New Hampshire deeds to their property, but New York's Governor Tryon claimed the region for his colony, demanded payment for the land when they had already bought it from New Hampshire. And each colony represented a different culture. New York, since the days of Dutch patrons, fostered vast manors owned by aristocrats and cultivated, as in Britain, by tenant farmers. In New Hampshire, most farms were small, worked by men who owned the land and lived on it. Now, this real estate feud was about to ignite. In March 1770, landowners from the Grants meeting in Conn, Connecticut, asked Ethan, just returned from his explorations, to organize defenses against New York. He accepted with enthusiasm of a man who enjoys a good brawl. His first stop was Albany, New York, where he tried unsuccessfully for a court settlement. That night he was about to ride to Bennington in the Grants. Two New York officials offered him a large tract of land if he would switch sides. He refused. "You should be advised," said one of the New Yorkers, "that we have might on our side, and you know what might often prevails against right." "Sir," replied Ethan, "the gods of the hills are the gods of the valleys." "What do you mean?" the man asked, justifiably puzzled. "If you accompany me to the hill in Bennington," Ethan answered, sense will be made clear." They stayed home, for in Bennington was a notorious Catamount Tavern, unofficial capital of the Green Mountain Country and off-limits to New Yorkers, like something like a biker bar. Its sign was a stuffed mountain lion, or catamount, fixed atop a 20-foot pole so that it snarled implacably towards Albany. With a court settlement scotched, Ethan quickly recruited a guerrilla army called the Bennington Mob at first. This rough corps of woodsmen was soon known throughout the colonies as the Green Mountain Boys. So they went from the Bennington Mob to the Green Mountain Boys. Reputedly as a safe, savage band, but Ethan invariably preferred oratory to bloodshed. For instance, the first clash was with a New York sheriff who invaded the Grants for 300 deputies. When the lawmen eyed their hard-looking opponents, and listened to Ethan's discourse about the Yorker blood that would be incarnating the mountainside, by God, they quickly melted away toward Albany. Used the same tactics, he spent the next 7 years waging guerrilla war against New York sheriffs, surveyors, and squatters. When Governor Tryon put a 20-pound reward on his head, Ethan retaliated with a 15-pound reward for the New York officials, whom he designated common disturbers of the public peace and response of the honest peasants of Bennington. Brazenly, he rode into Albany with a handful of his posters and tacked them up in taverns. Captured by a squad of redcoats in Connecticut several weeks later, he proposed a few drinks before starting for prison. Unaware of Ethan's reputation for holding his liquor, his captors were soon snoring under the tables while he trotted nonchalantly back to the Grants, perfectly sober. Not long after, he rode to the White Plains, New York, disguised as a British soldier. On the way back, he stopped at a local tavern long enough to tell the customers, "You might inform your government Ethan Allen has enjoyed a pleasant few days in his damned Providence." Okay, now we got a little bit more here. This thing is just falling apart. It's so old. There's a little bit left. Now, let's see here. If there's any more. Well, okay. All right. Okay. Then Governor Tryon upped the reward on his head to 100 pounds, Ethan replied. "My authority is this gun. I've run these woods these 7 years past and never was catched yet." I like his terminology here. "I was never catched yet." You know, it's kind of like Dr. Fred here. This is about as bad. New York answered by declaring any gathering of three or more people in the Grants illegal, punishable by death. Ethan dubbed the statute a bloody law and described its makers as malign, insatiable, avaricious, overbearing, inhuman, barbarous, and blood guilty. While condemning the ledger than Maine bribery, deceptions of one sort or another used by design schemers and land jockeys. But this rather comic real estate war was soon eclipsed. On March 13, 1775, settlers at Westminster in the Grants to protest the Parliament's opposition to tax policies were attacked by British sheriffs. Two settlers were killed and 10 wounded. A month later, on April 19th, Redcoats marched on Lexington and Concord. And shortly thereafter, following a hasty council of war at the Catamount Tavern, Ethan Allen was sitting comfortably in the office of Fort Ticonderoga's ex-commandant, enjoying that gentleman's good rum and penning cheerful letters. Then he received a letter himself from the Continental Congress at Philadelphia. It ordered him to remove immediately all cannon from the fort so that they might be safely returned to His Majesty when the former harmony between Great Britain and the colonies, so ardently wished for by the latter, renders it consistent with law and self-preservation. The dilly-dally idiots, Ethan exploded. By God, we're giving nothing back to the British except blow for blow. He sent Congress a searing retort, noting, among other things, that it is bad policy to fear resentment of an enemy. He followed this letter with another. I wish to God, he told Congress, America would at this critical juncture exert herself agreeable with indignity offered by her tyrannical ministry. She might rise on the eagle's wings, mount up to glory, freedom, and immortal honor, if she did not know and exert her strength. Fame is now hovering over her head. A vast continent must now sink to slavery and poverty, bondage, and horror, or rise to unconquerable freedom, immense wealth, inexpressible felicity, and immortal fame. I will lay my life on it that with 1,500 men and proper artillery, I can take Montreal. Then he headed for Philadelphia to argue firsthand, pausing only at Bennington to attend a church service of thanksgiving for the victory of Ticonderoga. The prayer was long, the Reverend praising God repeatedly for delivering up the fort. Parson Dewey, Ethan suddenly growled from his pew, aren't you going to tell the Lord about me being there too? Ethan Allen bellowed the old preacher, thou infidel, be quiet. Arriving in Philadelphia, Ethan won his case to keep Ticonderoga's cannon, and they were soon manhandled overland to Boston, where Washington's ill-equipped army used them to good effect against the British. Meanwhile, Ethan's oratory pushed Congress to allow the Hampshire Grants and New York to rally troops for an attack on Montreal. But, by an ironical twist of fate, Ethan ended up ignominiously as the leader of some 100 French-Canadian farmers he'd recruited in Canada as rebels. He had initiated the attack on Montreal, but was voted out of the official force when he returned to Vermont from Philadelphia to get it underway. The election of officers from the Grants was left to 50 older leading citizens. These religious men, long scandalized by Ethan Allen's lurid vocabulary and unorthodox ideas, ignored him completely. How the old man came to reject me, I cannot conceive, as much as I have saved them from the encroachments of New York, he wrote to a friend. But no, he was no sulker. When the Green Mountain Boys refused to serve without him, he traveled to Grant's, persuading them to march to Montreal under their new colonel. Then, determined to have some part of the campaign, he got himself appointed scout and crisscrossed Quebec, preaching politics to the French Canadians. He had recruited 100 farmers, some armed with pitchforks, when a Major Brown from the regular colonial army made an interesting proposal. Ethan Allen would cross the St. Lawrence River with his farmers and wait until near the city. Major Brown, with regular colonial troops, would come up in the east, and Green Mountain Boys would appear on the west. This would make a three-line force take Montreal. Ethan was agreeable, and that night he boated his men across the river despite the high winds and huge waves. But at dawn, he found that neither Major Brown nor the boys had joined him, and 500 British troops, augmented by Indians, were marching out of Montreal. Inevitably, the battle ended quickly, but as Ethan surrendered his sword, an Indian charged him. Well, Indian's charging now. Okay. All right, now. Okay, let me see. Here he's charging him. If I got this last page here. Interesting. All right, I did drop a piece on the floor here. Let me look and see what that is. Doing the story of Ethan Allen here. With some old documents from our family tree. And I mean, these are old. So that's not the page I'm looking for. All right. Let's see here. Okay, we read that part. Sorry to have to kind of break this up, but this is old. It's crumbling. Okay. Let's see here. All right. I'm getting to the point an Indian charged him. That's where we were. Okay, I don't know if I have that last page. Let's hope we did. I can tell the story without... Okay, here we go. Okay, he seemed to advance with more than mortal speed, Ethan wrote later. As he approached me near, this hellish visage was beyond description. Snake's eyes appear innocent in the comparison of his. His features extorted malice, death, murder, and the wrath of the devils, and damned spirits are the emblems of his countenance. And in less than 12 feet of me presented his firelock. At the instant I twitched the officer to whom I gave my sword between me and Savage, and he flew around with great fury, trying to single me out to shoot me without killing the officer. But this time I was near as nimble as he, keeping the officer in such position that his danger was my defense. But in less than a half a minute, I was attacked by just another imp of hell, and then I made the officer fly around with incredible velocity. Rescued by a British scout, he was taken to the city. When Montreal's commandant learned the prisoner was the captor of Ticonderoga, he wrathfully shook his cane over Ethan's head. I told him he would do well not to cane me, for I was not accustomed to it, Ethan said later. And when I shook my fist at him, telling him that was the beetle of immortality for him, if he offered to strike. Next, the commandant ordered the guards to bayonet the Canadians, as Ethan described the scene. It came to me to heart to see the Canadians in such a hard case, and in consequence of having been true to me, they were wringing their heads, saying their prayers, and expecting immediate death. I therefore stepped between the executioners and the Canadians, opened my clothes, and told General Prescott to thrust his bayonets into my breast, for I was the sole cause of the Canadians taking up arms. Ethan spent 6 weeks in irons and was obliged to throw out plenty of extravagant language. Once with his teeth, he twisted off a 10-penny nail holding his handcuffs and battered one of his guards. This is the part I like. Then he was transported to England. He was jailed in Falmouth, where throngs gathered to ogle his buckskin giant with fabulous vocabulary. He decided to keep up my spirits and daring in a soldier-like manner, that I might exhibit a good sample of American fortitude. With a noose hanging over his head, he resolved to accept death manfully, since as to the world of spirits, though I know nothing of the mode and the manner of it, expect it nevertheless when I should arrive at such world that I shall be well treated with other gentlemen of my merit. As the noose remained empty, for as a prisoner, Allen turned out to be an embarrassment to the British, because of his popularity with colonial folk hero, they feared retaliation if some of their own people had been captured and they should execute him. He also made himself popular in England. Finally, they shipped him back to New York with the idea of swapping him in a prisoner exchange. And that's pretty much the... And what happened was, I'll just tell you the story. Some of it's not written here. King George, he told King George that when he was in England, that he would haunt... After he was dead, he would haunt his castles and his family for eternity. So George then sent him back. He freaked out. When he got back from England, when he was shipped back, his first stop was at Valley Forge, where George Washington met him with many peculiar remarks about his approbation and esteem. According to Ethan Allen, then he returned home to Bennington, where he was greeted with a cannon salute and celebrated, at which Ethan put it, "We moved the flowing bow on rural philosophy, sweetened the friendship, and glowed in each in countenance." And I remember that from his deathbed, Allen roared a final mighty blasphemy at a startled clergyman before he died. He closed his eyes and died. He died of pneumonia, just like George Washington did. And that's pretty much the story. And the story I wanted to tell now is that back in the Revolutionary War, before when it started, the shot heard around the world, Colonel Parker came to Ethan Allen's side. He was the leader of the Green Mountain men, and said, "Ethan Allen, when's this war going to start?" And Ethan Allen told Colonel Parker, he says, "God damn it, in order to start a war, somebody's got to die." At which point Colonel Parker went out and fired the first shot that was heard around the world, shot one of the British militia down in cold blood. And back in 1984, I started a company with Dr. Donsbach. and Wes Parker. And Wes Parker was his great-great-grandfather, the same number of greats as Ethan Allen was mine, was the guy that fired the shot that was heard around the world. So my old great-great-great-grandfather told his great-great-grandfather to shoot somebody, and that's how it started. And that's our little story for the 4th of July. So anyway, now we're going to play a little bit here, a little Dr. Bell for you. You know, I know everybody needs a little Dr. Bell, and it's starting up now. And we're getting it off.
My background, basically,
a little background there.
For the tape, my name is Dr. Fred Bell. I started into energy when I was pretty small, about 6 or 7 years old. I was working at the University of Michigan when I was about 14 on atomic energy. And I went into the Air Force, and I was an early morning radar. And I worked around our defense system and spaceships and flying saucers and all the things that the Air Force doesn't want to talk about. I got out of that, I went into aerospace, and I worked with the late Wernher von Braun. We built spaceships. This was back in the mid-60s. And when I realized what the Air Force was starting to turn me against the system, back in the late 50s, and by the time I got into the mid-60s working for the government, you know, 10 years by this time, I was so turned against the system at this point in time that all I could do is not wait until the couldn't even wait till the space programs ended, you know, but I somehow or other made it through to the end. Got real rebellious towards the end of the space program, and I was working. My employer was Rockwell, but our contractor was NASA, and Rockwell was performing such a poor service for NASA, and it was the government's money, you know, the people's money that was being spent, that I filed a large grievance on behalf of myself against Rockwell for NASA. And promptly got fired for doing that. So I was out of a profession. You know, I was a professional scientist by this point. And the grievance was about fire hazards and human consciousness, the awareness of the job on the birds. And we were having a lot of fires. As a result of my grievance, is three people died down in the Cape. If you remember that one incident where the three astronauts died. And my grievance was to stop that from happening, because I could see that happening. So when that happened, then they gave me my job back, and I resigned, and I walked out. That was my end of the government spending. And I started studying with the Eastern teachers for quite a while. I spent a number of years with them, and I learned the Eastern way of life, which, when I studied Brahman science, made a lot more sense than the American science, because when I was studying quantum mechanics and quantum physics and things like that, all we would say in this country was that if you have a certain condition in a laboratory or an environment, a product, you know, a certain type of particle present, maybe something will happen, you know. It didn't mean anything to me. So with the Brahman science, they had names for families of energy, so I really began to work seriously with energy. Then I finished my PhD in homeopathic medicine and came back and started lecturing with the National Health Federation. And since that time, it's been about 6-7 years since I've been doing that. And I got, of course, we've been doing a lot of pyramid energies and developing the space travel devices that I was interested in developing back at NASA, but Uncle Sam wouldn't let us do that because it was a giant WPA project, and they figured it would be detrimental to the national economy to come on with these environmental projects too soon. They wanted to wait until we got into a situation like we're in now. The situation we're in now is that we've destroyed our water supply worldwide. We've raped our soil of minerals. Most people in the world are mineral deficient and not aware of it. And we're running out of air. So, you know, your feelings come from three different places. They come from, number one, your air. That's your first source of feelings. Second source of feelings comes from relationships, communication with each other, experiencing each other. And the third source of feelings comes from the food that we eat. Well, you can eat junk food for 10 or 15 years before it has a detrimental effect on the body. You end up with cancer or one of the diseases that you can have. It's your choice. You can have an argument with someone and have a bad relationship and still live on the physical plane for quite a while, maybe not feeling too well, or you can live in harmony. But if you just hold your breath for about 2 or 3 minutes and try to go out the door, you won't make it. So society has put a time, has put a fuse on the, on their, you know, you fused yourselves, basically. I'm not saying I'm not part of it, because I'm just as guilty as the next person. I'm just one that's trying to do something about it.
And you've viewed yourselves with your air supply, even though you look out here and it looks fairly clear. There's a tremendous amount of smog out here, even now.
There ain't a lot of air up there. And you realize how one of those big 747s with four engines on it, developing 56,000 pounds of thrust or horsepower, that's 200,000 horsepower being used per second, you know. That's a lot of air. You know, and the trees on the planet down here, which are supposed to rejuvenate our atmosphere, can't do that. Because what are we doing? We're cutting our trees down, too, to build houses. Look at the price of wood. So you see the dilemma that we're going into? So we do have to have intervention now. It's necessary because we've got to destroy, you know, this imagination. The government, the corrupt government, will have to be eliminated. And man can't eliminate it. God has to. Man tries it. He's called a rebellion. You know, we're called rebels or whatever. So we're going into what is called a revolution. And that's called the spiritual revolution. Now, my great-great-grandfather was the leader of a revolution, Ethan Allen, in this country. And they started a war in 1776. And we had a problem there. You know, people have a tendency not to get into action, even when all the facts were presented. Now, in 1620, when we came over here, we left England, right? To get away from taxation without representation is what we're having again right now, the same problem. So, well, first of all, we ran away from England. And when we ran away from England, we came here. The English just waited for us to get settled in our colonies, and then they began to infiltrate us, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there. So finally the colonies were a joke in England. They would probe us with their red coat regulars, and they would keep a fear trip going, like, you know, a paranoia always manifesting these times. And they kept us going, and so we didn't do anything about it. It started to get real bad. And then we decided we're going to have to get away and run them out. So we asked them to leave, and of course they didn't leave. So we had to organize ourselves. So the first thing we had to do was make our organization up and decide what we wanted to base our rebellion on. So we tried to draw up the Constitution of the United States, but when it was written, nobody would sign it. Okay, and John Adams, one of the people that wrote it, had a hell of a time even getting it written because there was such fight amongst the sons of the aristocrats that were at that time our representatives. Just like we have the same problems now. It's like having a bunch of representatives of oil companies. If you read some of the names back here on your chart, which is in the back room where the children are, you'll find that a lot of, like Lynch was there, who has Merle C. Lynch today. And you'll see a lot of powerful families in running this greed trip today that signed that Constitution. And John Adams used to, you know, just absolutely tell them off, you know. And of course, Benjamin Franklin was always soothing him and saying, well, this is the best you got to work with, man. You got to work with these people. So that conflict was going on simultaneously. It was George Washington who has more of the sons of the aristocrats over at Valley Forge. And he's waiting at Valley Forge, he's running out of food, money, and supplies for somebody to sign a Declaration of Independence so that he can start a war, you know, start shooting. But there's this huge stalemate. Nobody would do anything. Now, Ethan Allen came along. He was very rebellious, and he knew of both stalemates. And he was going on the inner levels. Well, we're always guided. I'll show some films later on today. Did that TV set arrive, by the way? It was supposed to come. We're going to need that later. Otherwise, we'll use mine, which is very small. And you'll see that there is an inner hierarchy, which we'll talk about late this afternoon, that guides this country. And so they got a person by the name of Saint Germain came and appeared on the balcony inside the Continental Congress room at a meeting and got him to sign that document. He gave a heck of a delivery of a speech, and this energy that he released motivated everybody to sign the document. Well, superphysically, Ethan Allen picked up on it, and he organized 50 people into a bridge in Lexington, Massachusetts, and he opened fire on a bunch of British regulars, just shot them down, you know. Then he went to Fort Ticonderoga, okay, and in the middle of the night, and the general was asleep, but he had 50 men as his weight outside, took a musket, took it up, went into the general's quarters and stuck it down his throat and said, pull the hammer back and said, surrender, you know. And I had no choice. So they go out in the courtroom and 800 soldiers come out half-dressed and put their guns in a pile and they take them Fort Ticonderoga. Then Ethan Allen sent a message down to George Washington and said, told him the massacre the day before and the capture of the fort that night. And he says, you better get rolling because as soon as the Brits find out about this, they're going to be shooting at you. So then away, then the war started. So that was the beginning of our war and our freedom. Well, the premise of the war, and it was George Washington, he was in the lodges, he was a Freemason and that. And our forefathers dedicated this land to the New Age people. They knew in the New Age that their sons and daughters would be the reincarnations of the Atlantean civilization, you know, the good side of the Atlantean civilization. They would get inherit the American soil. They knew this. The next thing happened was we had to symbolize this on the dollar. This is what we chose. So three other Lodge brothers, Van Buren, who became the president, Tyler, the junior thief, the pirate, got together, and they were also into the secret inner teachings and guidance of the countries. And they coined the Great Seal of the United States as a pyramid. This was in 1779. But the Continental Congress, which was a secondary, what I would say, level of consciousness, could not understand what the leaders were all about, even at that time, so they wouldn't put that symbol on the dollar bill until 1939 on the Series A dollar bill. So you begin to see that there's a tremendous gap between the true leaders of this country and the followers that have to take care of the pragmatics. In other words, there's a big gap between the president and the congressman or the senator. But as time went on, our beautiful values, the country became very rich. And when it became very rich, it became lazy. And that's the story of civilization, you know. You feed a lion real well, he doesn't go out and hunt anymore. He just lays around and lets the women do it, you know. And so the woman in this case was the women in this country. They physically went to work, and they were treated like hell. So we had the rebellion of the women. The women were doing everything in the early, you know, in a lot of manufacturing things in the late 1800s, early 1900s, in England and here too. And so you begin to see all of the things that go on in corruption beginning happen, and it happened. So we got some dues to pay. That's all there is to it. We have some dues at this time. So now we have the New Age leaders, people like myself. And we know, we can see, because we have the foresight to see what has been, and we're not afraid to admit where we are now. And that's why I wear my dunce cap here, this pyramid, because I'll leave this thing on until, number one, I've cleaned the air back up. Number two, restored the food back to the soil, back to its original condition. And number three, got rid of the water pollution. I'll do all three of those things. I may do it alone, or I'll do it with the help of anyone that wants to join me. And there are quite a few organizations now that are doing it, you know. Because my children are not going to, I'm not going to leave this planet without leaving it cleaned up for my kids, you know, and their generations. I have enough courage and enough respect for God at this point in the universe to, I don't care what was being done, I'm not going to say that my state is because of that. I'm going to change the state that I'm in by changing my state. So we begin to start somewhere. So I'll start with a slideshow now and show you about our own temples a little bit.
Well, we start with the root of the body, which is the colon. In the yogis, in the new yoga, it's the sacral chakra. But the primary organ of the body where all disease and degeneration begins is the large intestine. Now, how many of you in here have been to colon lectures? Anybody in here? All of you? Well, you have. Okay. And most of the main topic of the National Health Federation, and each of us has a part, like Dr. Yamayamas and Dr. Ellis and that are covering a lot with fluoridation and the effects of the water. In other parts of the country, we're talking a lot about colon therapy, and when I do most of my lectures with the National Health Federation, it's on the topic of poison environments and atmosphere and oxygen on the body. So now, the large intestine digests all of the minerals coming into the body. And my specialty in medicine is homeopathic medicine. I'm a homeopathic physician. So this is one of my degree areas where I've studied and specialized for the last several years. And we find that most people have colons that look like this rather than like this. 90% of people coming into our clinics look like that. And what's happening is why they look like this and shriveling up like this, this is a dehydrating effect right here. Now, this is the descending colon where it goes for release out. This is dehydrated due to what, this is what preservatives and food substances can do for you. It dehydrates the colon. Proper irregularity causes a stretching action in the colon. And most people that have had a heart attack and live from it did not have a heart attack at all, but the colon was stretched up, like on this one, up against the heart, and causes a cardiac restriction. So a heart attack has one symptom, death. Pseudo heart attack has cramping and everything like a heart attack, but there's not really a heart attack. A lot of people have had this symptom here. And of course, when they give nitroglycerin, this will help it because it forces the heart muscles into contraction and restriction back and forth, so it forces this away. But the ideal thing is colon therapy. A lot of people that are hyperactive, people come to me and say they're hyperactive, they've got too much energy, and they're jumping around like a nervous cat. It's not caused by an overactive adrenal and lots of adrenaline in the blood. It's caused by poisons in the blood. Okay? When I studied with the Tibetans put me through an exercise as the final initiation before I left their lamasteric care. And that's where a large amount of strychnine were placed in my body. Enough strychnine was placed in my body to kill 50 people. And that was to give the experience of what they call a death experience. And when this large amount of strychnine was placed in my body, I was taught certain meditation exercises, certain physical exercises, and certain yoga exercises, which I had to combine to move the poison out of my body so that I would not lose my form. The experience was very, very euphoric, but it was very rigid on the body. It was very nauseous. The American Indians did the same experience with the peyote button. They used to take the peyote button because any of these experiences stop the flow of serotonin on the pineal gland, which we'll cover in a little while, causing a spiritual experience or a revelation of our higher nature. It's done and brought before us. And I found that with a strychnine in my body, I had an excessive amount of energy. It did not stimulate the adrenaline. It gave me an excessive amount of energy. And this was a three-day ritual out on the desert. So what I had to do with the strychnine is I had to do running. I had to physically run for a certain length of time. Then I had to sit in what is called a kundalini position and do a large amount of breathing exercise where you go. What this did was put large amounts of oxygen into the bloodstream so that the oxygenated blood in the liver could take the poison from my body. And this exchanging process of large amounts of oxygen and excessive running and the meditation that went with it caused a complete discharge of the poison. And this would happen, it would come in rushes. It would be 3 or 4 hours of meditation in peace. Then the system would pick up a large amount of strychnine and go into like a spasm. You have to work through that and go into a peaceful thing. And each time as the poison decreased in the body, it pulled out other toxins with it, and the experience was a very high euphoric experience on the second day. The American Indians did the same thing, the same exercise as the Tibetans, only did it with a rattlesnake bite. The rattlesnake bite, the grave was put in a circle of rocks in a sacred burial ground or a sacred ground, and they had the blessings of the tribe. So this kept the air purified during this out-of-body experience so that some low influence didn't take the body, and the brave would let the snake bite him several times on the first day, and then he would be on fast for 3 or 4 days, maybe 7 days. And there was no administration to the poison in the body. It was not removed. It was consumed and converted. So that means that a human being with colon problems, with worms, can absorb the poison, can utilize the poison, but it's not the best way to go, and it's not a desirous experience. So the idea is to remove these things. The second thing that we find in colon therapy is the small intestine feeds the large intestine, and there's a valve called the ileocecal valve. Most people have a jammed or blocked ileocecal valve. I was a vegetarian for about 7 years before I had my first colonic, and I had a blocked valve. So when we put the barium in through here, the barium not only showed the deficiencies in the large intestine, but it went up in the small intestine as well. So the oxygen and water treatments that they give to get rid of this condition will also open this valve and it'll cause it to work properly. Okay? And digestion is an important thing to understand. And basically, the way the digestive process works in the human being is this. The enzyme is a chemical product or a chemical property that we all have. We have different enzymes to break down different foods. And the enzyme goes in on a chemical reaction, but is not consumed by that chemical reaction. So if we eat some food, and that's going to be broken down to form protein, certain enzymes are always required. Now the body can only process so many enzymes at a time. That's why they'll tell you to mix carbohydrate and fruit, or fruit and protein, or carbohydrate and protein, but not to mix fruit and vegetables. things like that, certain combinations, because the body cannot manufacture all these enzymes and produce them and digest them and process them in the stomach. So you end up with some kind of alimentary canal problem because you combine the wrong foods. That's why we have these little food charts out now. And a good thing that I learned from Pablo Arroyo, which I've always done, is that when you eat salads, eat your salad last in a meal. Don't eat it first. Because the salad distributes the hydrochloric acid all over the stomach. So the hydrochloric acid is needed along with the digestive enzyme pepsin to break down large fat molecules. So those of you that are eating meat and other heavier foods, if you eat the salad first, there's no hydrochloric acid left. So what happens is the meat is pushed on down through the alimentary canal and ends up impacting the colon and constipation as a result. So eat the salad last. Okay, that's why in Europe they always serve the salad last. So now when you eat foods, you start chewing the food, the first thing you do is you start releasing enzymes. Okay? The enzymes are released in the saliva. They're stored in the salivary ducts that's inside the mouth. The food with the enzyme is brought down into the stomach. There, it combines and begins to form the amino acids. The amino acids are called peptides and polypeptides. The best reason not to eat meat with the formation of these amino acids, because if you look at the peptides in an animal and the peptides in a human being, the peptides are in an animal are different than a human being, and the human body cannot absorb the aminos properly. An example of that, I'll just draw a typical thing right here. And here, these would be like papain, pepsin, and that. These would be peptides forming polypeptides, and they're carbon atom chains in the body. Now, the first one would represent a chain. And when these things are lined up like this, you have a complete amino acid. If in the case of an animal, you need an animal product, the first three might line up, the second three might line up, and they're absorbed, and they become denser. So this is an amino acid that's already in the body. This is the one to be digested. And as they digest, they combine chemically, making the nucleus of each amino more dense or solid. But in the case of an animal, maybe the first six would combine, but the last three would not. So you get a cancellation reaction. So two-thirds of the animal product did something, and one-third didn't. The one-third that didn't, what it does is causes an allergic condition in the body. And immediately when anybody eats meat, if you measure your blood pressure and your heartbeat, the blood pressure always goes up 20 to 30% with any person ever eating meat. Now, when the blood pressure in the heartbeat goes up 20 to 30% on the eating of meat, immediately causes the heart to go up in this rate, and it causes more heartbeats. The heart has X number of billions of beats in a lifetime, and if you're constantly eating meat, you're shortening the lifespan of the heart. The next condition that happens is in the arteries in the skin, epithelial cells. And what happens there is if you look at the skin, here's the surface of the skin, I'll draw it here. Right here, coming up like this. And epithelial cells in the arteries, the way the blood supply comes up, it makes a sharp bend at the surface of the skin and comes back down again. Well, what happens is when you're eating meat, the allergenic response causes an erosion at the top part of this blood vessel where it comes out to the surface of the skin. Just like if you have it like the Mississippi River, when certain rains come, it starts eroding out certain banks on the outside. This happens every time you eat meat. When this happens, the body has to repair that damage, and that's what cholesterol is for. So the body immediately, when this toxic condition comes on, starts secreting cholesterol. So that therefore, every time you eat meat, it causes an erosion of the arteries, an increase in heartbeat, an increase in blood pressure, and then a secretion of cholesterol. That's why a lot of people on high cholesterol and low cholesterol diets can't get the same results, because some of them on a high cholesterol are meat eaters and some of them aren't. Okay? That's the reason why, because of that toxic reaction. Whereas a vegetable protein, like a tomato, for example, won't cause this reaction in the body. Now, I'm not saying those of you that are eating meat don't do like I did. When I learned all these medical facts about meat eating, I immediately stopped eating meat, instantly. Just right there, triple Leo, right? No more meat eating. And what I did 2 years later is I went into protein deprivation. And when protein deprivation, when it manifested on me,
I came one day, I was looking, I had a normal arm, and all of a sudden this area in my arm turned bright red and swelled up a half an inch. And every portion of my body, this area of my chest, swelled up, became bright red, swelled up a half an inch. Areas on my legs, here, here, and here. My face, my cheeks swelled up, and my neck. So I was like a patchwork quilt. That condition lasted for 4 hours, and then it completely went neutral again, and the area that was swollen red went neutral, and the area that wasn't swollen swelled up. And I did that for 2 weeks. And then finally I found out that I had protein deprivation, and one of my teachers at the School of Axolotls in San Diego, I went down there to him and asked him what's happening to me. I'm flashing hot, flashing cold. I couldn't feel any mental changes, but I knew that something was wrong with my body, it's protein deprivation. He sat me down and says, "You're going to have a steak." And I said, "Wait a minute, I can't digest meat. I haven't had a piece of meat in 2 years. He says, "That meat." And he started frying the steak on the stove, and that smelled good. And I sat down and I ate that whole steak, and I felt so good afterwards. And my body immediately was recovered from that. I didn't go into that shock anymore. So if you go off meat, don't go off it. You know, immediately go off it over a period of 7 years. It takes 7 years for the body to regenerate a complete set of organs. And all of the endocrine glands have different hormones in them and different enzymes in them that have trained us to digest and assimilate the food as we know it in our habitual patterns. So when you make a transition, make one transition 7 years. If you're going off meat, you eat it 7 days a week, cut it down in the first year to say 5 days a week. And alternate your fish and your meat and your chicken like that. You have a question?
Is there a difference between vegetarian protein and animal protein?
Yeah, there is. There is. It's in the chemical structure. And it breaks down the polypeptides, like I was telling you about. There is a difference, right? Animal protein is very close to human protein. Now, eggs, things like that, are closer. Eggs are good for you. The rule that I always learned from my teachers, and I found that it works, if it falls off a tree, what's it going to do? It's going to rot. You know, it's common sense. A chicken lays an egg. If somebody doesn't eat the egg, it rolls off on the floor and breaks. So not saying in vegetarianism, abstain from protein totally. No, I eat eggs, I eat butter. These are natural byproducts of the animal. I just don't eat the animal itself. Chicken is not good for you, not because the chicken is not so good, it's because what the chickens are fed and raised. When I lived in Arkansas, we raised chickens. We raised a chicken in 19 weeks. We fed it full of chemicals and it just swelled out. This is a protein swelling. And most of the chickens that we raised had cancer or pneumonia when we would pick them up. They'd have growths on them, tumors, or they'd be breathing so bad, tremendous amounts of pneumonia. Because the chickens were growing so fast, and there was very little attention taken to their actual health. All they wanted to do was make them grow fast. And they were just a big mucus bag, so they weren't that good. So you're better off on fish. Fish is your best bet. And red meat better than chicken. Although in the old days, you've been better off eating chicken versus red meat. The idea is to rotate the meat when you're eating it. Now, the next thing is, when you digest, you chew the food up, it's mixed with the enzyme, it goes down into the upper part of the stomach and the small intestine. Here, it's broken down from protein to carbohydrates. Now, the carbohydrate is like an explosive or volatile mixture.
That's pretty much the end of that, and we hope you enjoyed this. By the way, that was an older tape, that back part that I didn't do live, and I don't eat any meat at all, fish or anything anymore, because it's all contaminated, and there's many, many better sources of protein. I'm a little wiser now than I was then. But hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll have another nice show for you tomorrow night. And next week we're going to have Stanton Friedman on with his newest UFO book, which is really great. So you've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Flow with the show, July 4th, 2008. Signing out. Whoa, there's a spaceship. It's Weddy.